Adults often stress about the anxiety, self-esteem issues, and social comparisons that their children are faced with on social media. But teens sometimes say there are positives, too. Some kids say social media platforms are keeping them informed and connected, and especially for teens with disabilities, it can make it easier to study. But lawmakers aren't so sure. An increasing number of states, including Wisconsin, are deciding whether to place age restrictions or parental consent requirements on some platforms moving forward. Welcome to Route 51. I'm Shereen Seewert. Today we hear about the advantages and disadvantages of social media for minors, the pros and cons involved, and whether the legislation proposed in Wisconsin will help balance the risks and rewards. We invite you to join in this discussion today by calling 800-780-9742 or email questions and comments to ideas@wpr.org. Our guest today has extensive experience studying the effects of social media on adolescent health. Dr. Megan Moreno wears many hats when it comes to this work. She is an adolescent medicine physician and researcher, a professor of pediatrics at the University of Wisconsin School of Medicine and Public Health, and is the co-medical director of the National Center of Excellence on Social Media and Youth Mental Health, among other titles. She is also the principal investigator of the Social Media and Adolescent Health Research Team, or SMART, at UW Health Kids, and that focuses on the intersection of technology and adolescent health. Dr. Moreno, thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you for having me.
Doctor, we hear a lot about the potential harm when it comes to social media and our kids. I feel like it's in so many headlines these days. But there's growing evidence that establishes both risks and benefits. So I really like to start out with some of the positives. What are some of the good things that kids are getting out of social media experiences?
I think that's a great place to start. And I think that a lot of what social media provides, particularly to adolescents, is really aligned with where they are in their developmental stage. So we know that during adolescence, it's really important for teens to develop their sense of identity, to develop a peer group, and to explore and learn new things. And most social media sites allow for each of those developmental milestones. It lets teens connect to each other and to acquaintances and to family. It lets them develop their identity and shift that identity as new interests develop. And it lets them reach out and learn new things.
How important are those connections to teens? I mean, to have that constant ability to reach out and be with somebody, even online.
I think that in today's era of adolescents being so incredibly overscheduled with so many activities and demands on their time, what we hear from some teens is that social media is really the main way that outside of school they can connect to their friends, tell a joke, catch up on what's happening. So for some teens, it can be incredibly important.
I would imagine during the pandemic, when a lot of schools were closed, it played an exceptionally important role.
It really did. And this was a time period where we saw some incredibly creative use of social media by teens. We heard about doing Facebook Lives with grandparents. We heard about social media as a way to connect to family that might be spread all over the country during the holidays. And we also heard about great learning opportunities. I know a patient that I cared for during COVID, she looked and signed up for virtual social media tours of all of the greatest art museums in the world.
Wow. Yes. Yes. I mean, there were some of those really great opportunities out there to learn and do this virtual travel that you could never do. How many kids are we talking about? I mean, how many kids are on social media? Is it virtually everyone or is it less than we think?
These days, what we mostly see in the yearly or every couple of year reports that come out of the Pew Institute for American Life are that about just over 95% of teens use some sort of social media. And it's also really important to recognize that social media is a really vast and diverse collection of platforms and activities. So it's kind of like saying, you know, 90% of teens try some sort of sport. And there's so many types of sport,
right,
that it's hard to say that that really means one thing. It's an incredible diversity of activities and platforms.
Do you have a sense of which platforms are the most popular right now with teens? I mean, I'm told the teens think Facebook is for old people now, which makes me old.
So.
I hear you. I hear you. Well, we do see shifts in popularity. And, you know, I think what we're starting to see now that we're about 15 years into social media is that teens do tend to want to flock towards the newer platforms. They want to be the early adopters on those platforms. And so right now what we see is that TikTok remains really popular. We see that Instagram is still quite popular. But what's really interesting to think about is the perennial most accessed social media is actually YouTube. And that just gets at how some aspects of social media that we might not even think are social media mm-hmm. are really woven into the daily lives of teens as well as adults.
I'm curious about whether there are some platforms that present more problems than others. Now, we do hear from law enforcement community about some of them, like Kick and others that can allow or can, I shouldn't say allow, but can promote some potentially unhealthy behaviors.
That's a really great point. And some of what I try to think about after doing this research for so long is kind of separating the platform from the functions it supports. So we know that a really key part of many of the functions of social media is identity development and allowing a teen to show who they are. So Instagram, for example, has a high identity functionality. It shows images of you. Many teens use their real name. But there's also platforms that allow for much less identity. So they allow for more anonymity or random comments. And we know that if you take the identity component away, if people feel like they're anonymous or secret, they're more likely to engage in naughty behaviors that on the surface they would think are not consistent with their identity. So years ago, we had the platform Yik Yak, which allowed everyone to post anonymously. And not surprisingly, it promoted a lot of bullying, a lot of harassment, and that platform eventually failed.
Well, let's talk about the bullying, because that's one of the things that critics point to a lot, the negative influence of the cyberbullying that is so prevalent online. How big a problem is this?
I think that in the current state of our knowledge, and this has really been looked at pretty intensely over the past decade, I think it's really come to be understood that cyberbullying most often is an extension of offline bullying, that kids who are experiencing bullying at school or in their offline lives, that bullying is pretty likely to extend into the online environment and vice versa. Kids who are being bullied online, it's often extending into the offline. So it really is a larger issue around bullying behaviors and less of a, oh gosh, this is a brand new thing with social media.
Does it make it worse, though? I mean, when I was a kid, if there was bullying going on at school, you went home and it was gone. I mean, you didn't have to deal with it after you got home. Now it never goes away.
Oh, just such a great point. Exactly. It does extend it, and it makes it difficult. I've had patients who have changed schools, and that doesn't always solve the problem if that bullying is extending into the online space. So I think it gets at the idea that what social media has the power to do is to amplify and broaden and extend things that are happening in the online life rather than creating new things that have never existed before.
We talked a little bit about social skills and being able to really express yourself. But critics say increased virtual activity has had a negative impact on social skills. Like, they, you know, kids might not know how to behave in the real world. Is that a valid point, or is it kind of one of those it really depends questions?
It's a little bit of both. I think it's absolutely a valid point. I think that adolescence is a time period where one of the really key developmental milestones is that adolescents understand different ways to communicate in the offline world, how to communicate with adults, how to address awkwardness and conflict and strife, and how to read body language and integrate understanding body language into your adult communication. And online, we don't see as many of the opportunities to learn those skills. Now, what's interesting is if you look in the communication literature, another time period where people were very worried about this is in the 80s and 90s, where kids would come home from school and spend hours on the telephone to their friends. And I was not exempt of that as a child of the 80s.
Sure.
And there was a huge worry because the telephone has even fewer social cues in how you talk to people. But in many cases, there's so many opportunities for teens to develop and have awkward in-person experiences that most folks end up building enough of those experiences. That's where COVID is a little tricky, because that was a time that was really devoid of getting to have a lot of in-person experiences. So it's worth thinking about that. It's an important piece of what we want adolescents to experience in the years to come.
Plenty of time to weigh in on this. We're talking with Dr. Megan Moreno about social media and youth mental health. 800-780-9742. You can also email ideas at WPR.org. I'd like to talk a little bit about self-image, and kids have a really hard time with this. Adults have a really hard time with this. Now, filters are really fun, but when you're seeing everybody's picture-perfect highlights, you know, their airbrushed body parts, the white teeth, the hidden imperfections, it can make it feel pretty impossible to live up to this standard, even for adults. So how are kids handling that? How are they affected?
That's such a great question. This is a really important topic in an area where we're seeing a lot of new evidence that's really helping us understand the potential impact. I think, like many things having to do with cognitive development and mental health, the actual impact on any individual adolescent is going to be quite different. And it really is going to differ based on the kind of messages they hear in their offline life from parents, from friends. It's going to differ based on their confidence, on their own mental health. So there's a lot of other factors in that equation. But at the same time, we know that repeated exposure to unrealistic body image ideals can lead to body image issues. And much of the evidence for how we know that started, you know, 40 or 50 years ago with people studying adolescents who looked at beauty and fashion magazines reported lower body image.
Yeah, I mean, I just know that it can be very difficult to look at all of those perfect people and think, how could I ever measure up to that? And I'm an adult.
It's very true. I think what's a little different between social media and some of the early studies in this area, and again, the early studies looked at beauty and fashion magazines and television shows, is what's different in social media is there's a lot of other channels and a lot of other types of input. So adolescents can choose to look at lots of different types of content and lots of different definitions of beauty by different cultures, by different body sizes. And it can take some work to disrupt the algorithm and be able to have different content as part of your feed. But that is something that social media offers that beauty magazines and television doesn't always offer.
What about narcissism and self-focus? I mean, do social media platforms encourage people to maybe think about themselves more often?
That's a great question. And again, I think this is a place where we can return to the idea that social media can amplify and broaden and extend, but it's not really inventing narcissism. For people who, you know, narcissism has been around for a long time. For people with that trait, social media might amplify it. It might extend it, but it's certainly not the first place where we've seen it show up.
Dr. Megan Moreno is our guest today on Route 51 as we explore technology and adolescent health. At the same time, lawmakers are considering a bill that would require parental consent and age verification by social media platforms. Ahead, what the kids say about all of this, and we'll answer your questions too when you call in 800-780-9742. You can also send an email to us at ideas@WPR.org. I'm Shereen Siewert. This is Route 51 on Wisconsin Public Radio. You're listening to Route 51 on Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Shereen Siewert. We're discussing the real-world impact of social media on adolescent health with our guest, Dr. Megan Moreno. Your comments and questions are welcome. You can email us at ideas@wpr.org or call 800-780-9742. Megan, a Pew Research Center survey last year of about 1,300 teens nationwide asked about the kids' thoughts, their feelings, and their use of social media. I read through the survey, and I guess it surprised me because teens tend to see their experience on social media as more positive than adults imagine it to be, and by quite a bit. Are adult perspectives skewed?
That's such a great question, and I think it's that we have really, as a society, focused on the narrative of risk and danger pretty much from the beginning of when social media launched. And that's not the first time we've done this with technology. Actually, if you look back at content from the turn of the century, the last century, when radios came out, there were a lot of inflammatory news articles about how the radio was going to corrupt our youth, and hearing music and dancing to the radio was going to really have this negative impact on society. And so I do think that anytime we see a major new technology roll out, there is this pushback and kind of a sense of moral panic of what are the risks. And I think that's a reasonable thing to think about. I think it's also the case that this narrative has played out for long enough that it might not be serving us as a society to focus on the negative when we see 95% of teens using these tools and about 75% of adults.
Yeah, I think often kids report on what went wrong in their day, and then they forget to come back and let us know when their issues are resolved or they're stopped being painful. I guess I just wonder, are we as parents worrying too much, or are students downplaying the negative effects?
And it's probably a little bit of a mix. And it may be that within the course of a day, an adolescent has a really positive interaction on social media of getting social support from a friend. But then maybe they see a photo of a different friend who's on vacation, and then they're sad that they don't get to go on vacation this month. And then they see a news story, and it gets them really worried about climate change or weather. So it's really important to also realize that it's not just one experience each day or the same experience for an individual over the course of the day.
In April, a bipartisan group of senators announced a new piece of legislation. It's called the Protecting Kids on Social Media Act. It would set a minimum age of social media users to 13. What do you think about that age? Is that appropriate? And I guess my question is, are younger kids more susceptible to the potential harm of social media?
This is a really tricky one because we don't have strong evidence to suggest that there's something magical that happens in adolescents' brains at age 13 that would make them higher or lower risk. And so it's always a little tricky with a universal age cutoff, if we don't really have good evidence for why that would be there. So I think that's one flaw. I think that there's a lot of kids out there that 13 might be too young. And we see adolescents saying, hey, I know eventually I'm going to get on social media, but I'm going to wait another year because I know myself. So I think there's some flaws in the idea that we can have a one-size-fits-all. I think the other flip side of laws like this is the verification of the age can be incredibly disruptive to families' privacy.
And I wanted to touch on that, too, because, I mean, there are some privacy concerns there as well. And I know there are a lot of legal questions surrounding these bills, too. One other thing that the bill would require is parental consent for teens between the ages of 13 and 18. From your point of view as an adolescent health expert, how do you feel about that parental consent, portion of that legislation?
I think this is a tricky one as well, both because for some adolescents who might be in dangerous or risky home environments or social environments where social media really becomes their one safe place or their place to go to get support, requiring parental consent can take away that last safe place for them. One of the things I think back to when I first got exposure to social media was around 2008, I was working in in a homeless youth clinic. And many of the patients we saw had found out about our clinic from MySpace, if you can believe it. Mm-hmm. And so it really drilled down to me that this social media can become a resource and a lifeline for really vulnerable kids. And I think that parental consent could put them in further jeopardy. And then the other piece is, how do we get that parental consent? How does it verified? And again, that starts to become quite an invasion of privacy for families.
We're talking with Dr. Megan Moreno, our guest, discussing social media, its impact on adolescent mental health. And you can join in as well at 800-780-9742 or email ideas@wpr.org. One aspect of the Utah law that went into effect requires social media companies to block minors from accessing their platforms from 10:30 p.m. to 6:30 a.m. I mean, the technology aside, like, how are they going to police that, I guess? But what do you think about a curfew? Why do you think that was included? And do you think that's helpful?
That's another really interesting take, and there has been some other curfews tried. For example, in Korea, there's been some tries of some national curfews for the internet. I think in very small, focused populations, I think sometimes those types of curfews can be somewhat effective. But again, I think that something that's really a one-size-fits-all can be really really challenging to think of as a viable solution. 10:30 is probably way too late for certain kids. And for other kids who may be in online school or have different schedules due to other factors, it may be really a challenge for them. I think overall, though, the one-size-fits-all in really regulating the family versus regulating tech platforms is an approach that's going to run into some difficulties to be long-term.
We spoke with an expert earlier this year on human trafficking, and our guest that day said that these kinds of social media bills that are circulating both federally and in Wisconsin can't happen soon enough from a human trafficking standpoint. She said that this is a crucial step in combating trafficking. What do you think about that?
I think there are certainly areas in which these types of steps could do an incredible amount of good. And I think what's challenging for us as such a diverse and heterogeneous society is understanding that for other sectors of the society, for example, for LGBTQ youth, for marginalized youth, in some cases for youth with chronic conditions, these types of laws could be absolutely devastating. And so I think that's what's difficult. We need to think about how it impacts the issues that are important to us, as well as the issues that are important to others.
A lot of the legal conversations about social media have to do with privacy concerns, which you have mentioned, not just personal information, but the way social media companies target young people with advertising through the AI algorithms. I mean, are you, as a health expert, worried about these kinds of issues when it comes to kids on social media, the algorithms and how they are targeted?
Oh, definitely. I think this is an area where we would benefit from additional evidence and some additional thought partnership, because this really gets at how do we work with technology companies to ensure that the platforms are not designed to hurt youth. And we know that these platforms are designed by adults with adult mindsets and with adult users in mind. They're not designed for kids or for their developmental needs. And we know that the algorithms are designed to maximize providing little nuggets to keep kids online. So I think this is a place where shifting our attention from regulating families and regulating privacy, I think starting to think about how are those algorithms designed, I think that's a really promising place where we could make these spaces safer for kids.
Well, a whistleblower in 2021 made headlines alleging that Meta, the parent company of Facebook and Instagram, was sitting on pretty extensive research into how its platforms, especially Instagram, hurt kids' mental health, didn't take action to address those problems. There's a lot of this in the news. So what action could social media platforms take to limit the harm? Are there in-app tools that you'd like to see implemented that would make them safer?
I think that some of the promising developments I've seen in discussions with tech companies and with child health-centered organizations like the American Academy of Pediatrics and Common Sense Media and Project Zero, some of the folks out there that are really focused on the child health aspect, have been to really think a lot about protecting teens' privacy and limiting the advertising that is allowed to be targeted towards teens, and thinking about giving kids more agency in these spaces. So the algorithm is designed to follow what users do, but could we not say follow what users do, but actually think about the teen themselves and give them some agency maybe to reset their algorithm or to be able to go in to a some part of the platform and say, I don't want to see content from here, here, or here anymore, and allow them to have more say in what they see.
Yeah, I guess all of those things, though, have to be set by someone, right? Like, somebody has to set those parameters. The user does. So can kids set those realistically for themselves? Do you think that's a good idea?
I think that we often underestimate adolescents' tech skills and overestimate their, you know, professional level skills. So I think from a tech standpoint, I think absolutely adolescents could go in and change settings. But I think what we would need to do on the other side is provide them support and education and agency around how to know when content is making them feel bad about their self-esteem, how to know what kind of content is probably not going to be good for them to see given their own context and life experience.
What are some of the warning signs that parents should look for that social media behavior is maybe becoming a little unhealthy for their child? What should parents be looking for here?
Well, one of the things I think about as a pediatrician is that when you have an infant, the infant has one set of skills to get your attention. They're going to scream and cry, and you might not know what they want, but you know that they're running into trouble and you need to try some things. And for adolescents, I think you actually have some similar skill sets, which is that, or similar signs, being that an adolescent will often withdraw. They will not want to engage with the family. They might be more irritable or more sad or more sullen. And just like with an infant, those signs could mean a lot of different things, but it usually means that you as a caregiver need to start asking some questions and figuring out what's causing those signs.
Yeah, have a conversation, right?
Yes, yes.
Do you have a sense of how much time kids are spending on social media these days? I mean, how many hours a day are we talking about?
Well, I like that question, and what I often feel tempted to do is for anyone listening today to ask themselves if they can accurately calculate how long you spend on your phone each day.
Yeah, you know what? There, some phones have those tools that'll give you a screen report every week, and it's interesting. I get one every week that shows me how much screen time I spent on my phone, and sometimes I'm like, wow, wait a minute. Did I really spend that much time on my phone? I mean, those are kind of interesting tools that can be used.
They are. And so much of our time is in little drips and drabs, yeah, which makes it really, really challenging to calculate.
When it comes to teens, are the risks involved in social media use really exponentially changed when they're spending more time? Like, there's got to be a relationship here, right? The more time you spend, the more potential harm there might be. So is there a good timeline to follow?
I think this is another area where one size fits all is a bit challenging. But I think a way that we can flip that question is to say, what are the really important things that teens need to do every day? They need to get enough sleep, probably between 8 and 10 hours. They need to get about an hour a day of some sort of physical activity. They need to go to school, get their homework done, have some interaction with their family. And if you add up all the time for all those things, then it can help teens figure out, okay, what time is left and how do I want to spend that time?
And the constant checking and scrolling can have a pretty detrimental effect on schoolwork and studying if they're constantly being, you know, checking their phones for updates on Snapchat or TikTok. How do you suggest kids break that habit? When you are working with your patients, what do you say to give them tips to just stop doing that all the time?
That's a really great question and a really great approach to think about if you within your family or your teen wants to try to think about more mindful social media use, is identify time periods where you're really going to be better off not engaging with your phone. So maybe that's during homework. One that has a really strong evidence base is avoiding bringing your phones to the dinner table and really being able to engage and talk during dinner. Maybe it's during your family movie night, making sure that you're not reaching for that second screen when you're meant to be relaxing with your family and watching something else.
What about feelings of missing out? This is one of the things that one of my sons shared with me. He said that, you know, he was fearing that if he wasn't scrolling through social media enough, he might miss something, a message, a joke, or something else that connected him to his peers. How big a factor is that for kids, and how do you get past that?
That's such an important phenomenon, and it's really something that has existed and is a pretty normal part of adolescent development. Adolescents are meant to start focusing more on their peers and role modeling their peers and connecting to their peers versus younger kids who really focus on role modeling and connecting to their parents. So it's pretty normal to be thinking about, gosh, is something going on? What do I need to know? What might be happening? And so that phenomenon has been around for a long time, and social media just provides this new tool where you can actually see in real time what people are doing. So I think that an approach is to normalize that it's really normal to feel this way, and that it's probably not going to be possible to know what everyone's doing all the time. And so starting to get comfortable with that idea.
Dr. Megan Marino is our guest today as we discuss the intersection of digital media and adolescent mental health. This is a time when state and federal lawmakers are considering ways to regulate social media use by minors. And we'd love to hear from you, too. You have time to weigh in at 800-780-9742. You can also send an email to ideas@WPR.org. I'm Shereen Seward. This is Route 51 on Wisconsin Public Radio. You're listening to Route 51. I'm Shereen Seward with our guest, Dr. Megan Marino, who is the co-medical director of the National Center of Excellence in Social Media and Youth Mental Health. What would you like to know? Email us at ideas@WPR.org or join us by phone at 800-780-9742. Megan, tell us about the National Center and when this all started.
Well, we are so excited about the launch of the National Center of Excellence on Social Media and Youth Mental Health, which is located within the American Academy of Pediatrics. And the American Academy of Pediatrics is the major organization for the United States pediatricians, and it's really the organization that sets policy and practice around child health and training pediatricians to deliver the best in child health. So this is a fantastic place to have this center so that we can serve pediatricians, child health providers, patients, and families.
So how did you personally get involved?
I have been involved as a pediatrician. I've been involved with the AAP throughout my career. And within the AAP, I have contributed to some of the training and the policy statements that have focused on social media over time. And so I was really excited to be one of the two co-medical directors representing my expertise in social media and adolescent health. And our other co-medical director is Dr. Radesky, who's at the University of Michigan, and her expertise is in infant and young child digital media use. So we really have the age span covered.
Well, so what are some of the main goals of the center, and how's it going so far?
It's gone very well. What we have been focusing on over the first year is building out the public presence for the center. And that, not surprisingly, is located online. And so you can Google AAP Center of Excellence. You can Google AAP social media, mental health, any of those word salads will get you to the center website. And one of the key parts that we really wanted to put up front first is that we have a question and answer portal on the topic of social media and youth mental health where you can go in and submit a question.
So tell me about that portal. And this is a new thing. Who is it meant for? Is it for kids, for parents, for doctors? Who is it for?
Well, it's meant for any of those that you mentioned that have a question about social media and youth mental health, really for all comers who have a question that they want to get answered. And the way that we are approaching this is that we really wanted to center on evidence-based answers. So not an opinion or what we believe or what we think we might have seen. It's really focused on what is available in terms of evidence. So for every question, we have a team that reviews the scientific literature and pulls out the best available evidence to help parents and teens and providers and educators have that evidence-based answer.
Give me some examples of the questions that you've been getting so far.
Sure. So we have been categorizing the questions based on the age group and on the topic. So here's an example of a question. How does a parent begin to set limitations on tech time when there are none to start with? How does a parent deal with a spike in aggressive behavior due to these new limitations?
And what's the answer to that? I'm putting you on the spot now, but that's a great question.
You know, I think that we really liked this question because it's so incredibly common. And I think one of the things we wanted to emphasize in that answer is that it's really never too late to set some boundaries. And the later you do it, it can be more challenging, but it's never too late. And really emphasizing that it's a goal of having more time for family, for sleep. It's really a health-based approach. So some of what we've seen in the evidence out there is that having a tool to be able to sit down with your child and create some of those guidelines and boundaries together is a very good practice. And there is a tool called the Family Media Plan where parents can sit down with individual kids and say, let's look at these examples of possible rules and guidelines and let's decide together on what we think is going to be the best path forward.
Critics say social media platforms are designed to be addictive. I'm curious if that aggression response suggests a potential addiction.
It's possible that that could suggest definitely an over-reliance on those tech behaviors. It also could suggest just a frustration of having had no limits for a long time and suddenly limits. So I think it's a little tricky to know, you know, what is the root cause for that particular kid.
I mean, are kids truly becoming addicted to social media? Is that happening?
We do see that some kids have problematic use. And when you think about, okay, what is problematic use? It really represents a spectrum. It can represent everything from choosing not to go out to a social event because you'd rather be online to having more compulsive or addictive or aggressive behavior. So it really is a spectrum, and most kids don't fall on that extreme.
No, it's. I remember when I was a teenager, none of this was, you know, I'm too old for all of this. But I mean, I remember when my mom read my diary and I felt so exposed and just like it was the worst feeling. And I've heard that from parents who say when they talk to their kids about social media and they're checking, because you're always told you should be, you know, keeping an eye on what they're doing and check their accounts. They feel really violated. How do you talk to your child about that to help them understand that this is it's meant to help you, not to invade your privacy?
I think this is a tricky one, and I think that different families have different sets of rules around this. What we've seen and what the evidence suggests is that being transparent about what the rules are and being consistent with the rule are the main ways that that rule will be effective. So doing the checking in ways that don't feel transparent or don't feel consistent if you haven't checked in a year and suddenly you want to, that can feel really invasive because it feels like you haven't done mm-hmm. it in so long. Why now? Mm-hmm. So again, I think with any rule, it's got to be transparent. It's got to be consistent.
Mm-hmm. Well, one of the things the center has tasked with is translating the growing field of research around actionable solutions to protect youth mental health online. One aspect of this that caught my eye is a family media plan. So what is a family media plan? How can you go about creating one and implementing one in your home?
Yes, we love the family media plan. And one of the things I love the most about it is that it is a family media plan. It is not a teenage media plan. And so it is an online tool that families can go into and select who is going to be part of the family media plan, which kids, which adults. And within the media plan, there are a wide variety of categories you can address. Everything from screen time rules to content rules to privacy setting rules. And one of the things we really encourage families to do is to not feel like the first time you go into it, you have to do everything at once. We recommend going in and saying, you know what, our family seems to be having some issues with privacy settings. So for today, we're just going to go into the plan and focus on the privacy and the safety piece. And then next time, maybe we'll go in and talk a little bit more about media balance or about screen-free times. So it is a tool you can return to.
You know, you emphasize the family part of this media plan. How important is it for parents to follow their own guidelines and show kids that they're being responsible as well?
Oh, it's so critical. And I think we're entering an era where we're going to see more studies and more recommendations and more evidence really focusing on the role of parents. We know that parent role modeling of their own smartphone and social media use is so much more important than even any setting rules at home. So I sometimes joke that when I started doing this work 15 years ago and I was in clinic, everybody was concerned about the teen that would be on their phone and be ignoring you down during the visit. That really has gone away. And what we worry about now is the parents who aren't listening because they're immersed in their phones.
Mm-hmm. Well, we talked earlier about all of the positives that social media can bring for kids. There are a lot that we listed. So how can parents teach their kids to use social media for good while staying safe?
You know, I think parents can feel confident in their ability to be parents and their ability to get to know their child and get to know what their child's interested in and talking about family values and family approaches. And those types of communications really translate well into how teens navigate social media. So the offline context is so important in how teens will choose to navigate social media. But I think also having check-ins, having conversations, asking directly, how is it going navigating Instagram? What have you seen that you like? What have you seen that kind of freaked you out? Like, what do you want to talk about? And even if you're a parent who never wants to understand or be on Instagram, you can still listen and stay focused on your role as a parent.
Social media rules at home can be a little bit different during the summer or during fall break or winter break. So when a new semester is starting, is it a good time to do a reset? What do you suggest?
Definitely. I think it is a great time to sit down and take a look at something like the family media plan and say, hey, what do we think is going to work as we go into the next school year? I think it's also important to recognize, even though parents' schedules might not change as much during summer, sometimes parents get a little more lax with their own media use or their own phone use. And so that's another place where parents can say, hey, I've decided I'm going to work on making sure I don't have my phone at dinner. What do you think about you do that as well? So parents can really role model that it's okay to revisit and set some new guidelines for what you want the family's environment to be.
You said earlier today that social media really isn't one size fits all. Can you expand on that a little bit? What do you mean by that? That social media isn't just one thing?
It really isn't one thing. And I think I'm going to reach for the analogy of sports again and just say that, you know, age restrictions, protective equipment, risk of injury, those are dramatically different if your child's in football versus if your child's in golf. And understanding that making a rule that kids can't do a certain sport at a certain age and applying that to all sports feels like it's really being broad and not going to actually help kids navigate the complex world of different types of sports. And I think that analogy can be helpful for social media because social media is made up of so many different things, and a one-size-fits-all for every kid and every platform is probably not going to give the benefit that we would hope it would.
Well, you know, there are the benefits that we've talked about, but there again are the dangers, and one of those is some of the unhealthy relationships that are created on social media. We hear about predators who lurk and luring kids, through chats. What are some of the dangers here, and what can parents be doing about this?
I think that is a really real risk, and the risk of unwanted solicitation, of unwanted approach by adults, of unwanted relationships with adults, that is something that has existed since before social media. I remember growing up with stranger danger, but social media has allowed new opportunities for folks to misrepresent themselves or reach kids. So it is a real thing that parents can talk to their teens about in terms of having focusing their social media time on people that they know in their offline life, their peers, their friends. And if there's anything about an approach or communication that's making them uneasy, giving them a set of people that they can talk to about it to be able to check into that relationship before things go too far.
Do you feel concern about artificial intelligence? I mean, AI is ramping up like crazy. And as more of this artificial intelligence comes about, do you feel like the risk of these kinds of negative interactions and problematic interactions are going to increase?
I think that what signs are suggesting to us with the, as you mentioned, the rapid speed and distribution of AI, I think there are a lot of reasons to be concerned about how people are able to communicate and represent themselves. And I think we'll need to try to be even more careful about who teens and adults are interacting with as we try to navigate this new scary but kind of exciting world of adaptive AI.
Mm-hmm. Circling back to adolescent mental health and the connection with social media, is there a connection that you found in research that connects social media and youth depression, youth suicide rates? And as we talk about that, I do want to remind listeners, if you are struggling with thoughts of self-harm, the 988 Suicide and Crisis Lifeline is available.
This is such an important question, and this is something where there's been an incredible explosion of news coverage and bringing forward a lot of opinions to the table. I think when we look at the evidence, what we see is there are horrific and tragic cases in which adolescents struggling with depression had negative interactions and experiences that may have been part of the really complex and devastating outcome of suicide. What we also know from evidence is that when you look at an entire population and try to look for the connection between depression and social media, it becomes a very small effect, which suggests that it's really complex and really variable by the person, by their own traits and genetic history and environment. And so I think that sometimes we miss out on the opportunities to think about these tragic cases and prevention and how do we find the kids who truly are at risk, because we're distracted by the idea of the population effects and the idea that social media is like a virus that infects kids with depression, when that's really not the case.
That is good to know. Again, the Suicide and Crisis Lifeline is 988. A text line is also available. Text HOME to 741-741. Bottom line, if these bills do succeed in Wisconsin and federally, do you think it'll have a positive impact on adolescent mental health? Will it work?
I'm not confident that these bills would be the answer to such a complex situation. And I worry that they would take away agency from teens and families.
Do you think these bills in some form could work, or just there just needs to be a lot of discussion about it?
Well, I think that if you think back historically, prohibition worked. It worked at reducing, rates of alcoholism and fatal vehicle crashes, but it also took away a lot of agency. And I have heard a couple people mention that these bills, we can think about a little bit with prohibition and to what level we are willing to take away personal freedoms and privacy to try to be protective.
Well, I want to thank you so much for your perspective. It's been really valuable. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
This is Route 51. I'm Shereen Seward, extending one more time a sincere thanks to our guest, Dr. Megan Moreno. Our producer is Joy Ratch Kramer. Our executive producer is Rick Ryer. Rick is also our on-air producer today. Thanks to John Altenberg for the Route 51 theme. You can hear the archive of today's program and previous programs at WPR.org/Route51. If you have an idea for a future program, get in touch. Ideas@WPR.org. We'd love to hear from you. Next week, we'll be back, and we hope you join us. But until then, we're heading out of town.